This Week in Radio Tech, episode 280, is brought to you by the Axia Fusion AOIP Mixing Console. Fusion, where design and technology become one. By the ZipStream R2 Hardware Audio Processor and Stream Encoder. Stream like you mean it with a ZipStream. And by Lavo and the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. Online video, like Netflix and YouTube, have used adaptive bitrate streaming for a few years now. The same tech is becoming available for audio streamers, like radio stations and other online audio broadcasters. Tim Posar, streaming director for Fandor.com, joins Chris Tobin and Kirk Harnack to teach us about adaptive streaming technology. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Glad to be here. I'm really excited about this show. We've got a great guest for you. And, of course, our usual lineup of superhero hosts like, well, okay, well, there's me. And then the best-dressed engineer in radio is Chris Tobin from New York City. Hey, Chris, welcome in.
Hello, Kirk. I'm doing well, yes. Today it's a dressed-down day and doing some work in a terminal room, but having a good time.
Cool. Hey, can you are you in the city? Or are you in the North Jersey, or where are you at nowadays?
New Jersey. I'm in Newark, okay. New Jersey today.
I'd ask for a weather report, but it looks like it's kind of punchy around there.
It's raining.
Is it really?
Supposed to be 10% chance of rain today, and so far it's a deluge. That's their idea of 10%.
We're going to bring our guest in here in just a minute, but hey, if you've tuned into this, then you've tuned into the show about radio and audio engineering and RF engineering for radio. It's This Week in Radio Tech. This is episode number 280, and normally every 10 episodes we do a war stories episode where we talk about, you know, some crazy experience we've had that we can learn from. And I've asked our guest, who we'll bring on in a minute, I've asked our guest to think about some crazy episode in his engineering life that, you know, maybe we can all learn from. And while we're thinking about it, maybe Chris Tobin can come up with something as well. In the meantime, though, the show's topic is about something that's new, not about, and you know, well, actually there will probably be war stories about this new topic as time goes on. But we're going to be talking about adaptive streaming technology. You know, we've had streaming for a few years, and there are all kinds of conditions that affect whether a stream can be received by a given listener. And so we're going to talk about adaptive streaming technology and how to put that to use. So hang on for that. We're going to get right to that in just a minute. Our show, let me go look at the rundown. This is a new thing for Kirk here. I'm supposed to intro the guest according to the rundown. So let's do that now. Our guest, welcome him in from California, Tim Posar. Hey, Tim.
Hello. Hi.
How are you doing?
Good, good. Actually, San Francisco in particular, and my office here in the Jackson Square area of San Francisco.
Cool. And you and I were talking about something that you do, and it's a website that I don't think I'd really heard of until we talked, and that is a website called Fandor. Tell us about that and what you do there.
Sure. Fandor, well, sort of the quick elevator speech is it's a subscription video on demand service. So it's much like Netflix, where you pay, you know, your $8 or $10 or whatever a month, and it's all the films you can eat. In this case, the films that we do are the ones that Netflix usually doesn't pick up. It's much like it's independent foreign language films, film festival films, kind of the RC kind of stuff that you would see Criterion have. So it would be Kurosawa films and Werner Herzog and those sort of films. So if you're a real cinemaphile, this is the place to be to sign up and watch this kind of stuff. It's designed to try to also help out those people who create these kind of films. So we try to, you know, extend the income for these kind of films, because normally they just do the film festival circuit and then they put them on the shelf and they don't make any more money. And if they can put it on our service, then maybe we can pay them a little bit more for their efforts.
Cool. Cool. The site is Fandor, F-A-N-D-O-R, and you have a free trial program. So people might want to check that out after this show is over. And speaking of this show, again, coming up, we're going to be talking about HLS and other types of adaptive streaming. So stick around for that. Hey, our show, This Week in Radio Tech, is brought to you by some sponsors. And one of those sponsors is Axia and the Axia Fusion audio console. Now, Chris Tobin is familiar with Axia technology. He installed some Element consoles. Element was the the predecessor to the Fusion. The Fusion is, you know, is a successor to that, in that it takes Element technology and improves on that. Some all metal construction, for example, OLED technology for the displays to show at a glance and very clearly what the input channels are, confidence meters for the incoming audio, also confidence meters for the backfeed audio. So, you know, if your talent is out in the field and says, I can't hear you, well, you know, you can say, well, I'm sending you audio. I see it right here. Let's find out where the problem is, because it's not the console. The Fusion console from Axia is simply amazing. And I want to point out that this is a console that will last you for years and years. I got to estimate that this is a decades console that Axia is putting out. Why do I say that? Because the top panel, the thing that gets all the finger work, you know, all the hands touching it and the dirt and the grime, it's made out of double anodized, laser etched, brushed aluminum. It is amazing in that the markings on it, you know, the dB level markings and the any other markings that are near any buttons around the faders, near the knobs, it can't wear off. Can never ever wear off. They're laser etched in there and then double anodized. You can't rub them off. You can't scrub them off. Now, if there's dirt on it, yeah, you can wash that off, and guess what? The dirt goes away, and the markings stay right there. It is really gorgeous. The bowl nose is metal. The overbridge is metal. The end caps are metal. Of course, the underpan is metal, and it feels so solid and like it'll put up with years and years of heavy-duty service. Now, Fusion console, like the Element console, and I know Chris Tobin configured a number of elements, the Fusion console is custom configured the way you want it. Faders come in blocks of four. You can also get a telephone module that comes with two faders and then telephone controls right down the middle of it with clear status symbols on there that you can see exactly what the status of the different phone lines is. It comes, or you can get an intercom module that lets you page right away up to 20 different intercom stations and be ready to listen to other intercom stations when they call you. You can dial your telephone with the main module on this thing, the main monitor module. You can select headphone, what you're listening to in the headphones, the monitor selection. It's amazing how you can lay this console out. Oh, you can also get buttons that are either film caps, so they're fixed buttons, or you can get buttons that have text that's writable on there. Our software called Chris, help me out here. I'm having a senior moment. What's the software called? Pathfinder. Our Pathfinder software. Yeah, our Pathfinder software will write on the buttons and can change their function if you want to. You can have buttons that scroll functions up and down. We even wrote a whack-a-mole game on the buttons just to show how fast they work and how quickly the button reactions are to the commands that you give it. The Fusion console, of course, is the thing that sits on the desk or is embedded in the desk, whichever you like. But the rest of it is the usual Axia equipment, the nodes for inputs and outputs, the studio mixing engine, the power supply for the console itself. And you can get all those things combined in the Axia power station, or you can do a separate system. So show that picture one more time, the beautiful Fusion console from the website here. Go to axiaaudio.com or you go to telusalliance.com. Either way, we'll get you there. And click on Axia and the Fusion console. This is a serious console for serious operations and will last you for many, many years. Put a bunch of those in, including, hey, just up the road from you, Tim, in San Francisco at the Assembly Stations.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's a beautiful installation there. Thanks a lot to Axia for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech, and I'm happy to talk to anybody about the Fusion consoles. There's videos online, by the way, on our YouTube channel, youtube.com. Look for Telos Alliance and go to the Axia playlist, and you'll see some videos about the Fusion console. All right. Tim Pozar is here, along with Chris Tobin and Kirk Harnack, yours truly. We're here to talk about streaming, and let me go back to the rundown here so I don't mess this up. This is so new for me, your actual rundown. All right. We're going to talk about the status of streaming and where congestion points are. And, hey, this is a real teachable part of our show. We're going to have some slides here. And, Tim, why don't you talk us through some of these concepts that you developed to talk to other engineers about. And, hey, Suncast, go ahead and pop the slides up whenever it seems appropriate to, okay?
Well, thanks. I got invited by Steve Lamp, and I probably assume that he's been on your show, or at least most of the engineers that watch this know Steve. Steve's been an old friend. I knew him back when he was chief engineer at KJAZZ over here, and I was chief at KLOK and KKSF. Steve, knowing that I'm in this area at this point, sort of left broadcasting in 96, I've been trying to figure out a way of actually making sure that the kind of material that we're pushing out, and I sort of jokingly call it audio with pictures in this case for you guys, makes it to our end customers. They pay, you know, $10 a month, and they want to be able to make sure that the films that they watch can be an immersive experience. You don't want to have get in about 10 minutes into the film and all of a sudden the little beach ball shows up. Oh. And you have to wait for the next minute or two for it to queue up another chunk of film. Yeah. And that just doesn't work. People are going to leave in droves after that kind of stuff. So originally we had a lot of that kind of stuff. We had a lot of those sort of problems. The congestion points are many. And so there's not just one sort of solution to be able to make sure that the audio stream or the video stream, in our case, with audio, gets out to the customer intact. And so I put together a little presentation that I did at AES a couple days ago, and yeah. I think you still have those slides. But
yeah, let's look at the first slide, which is the multi-layer OSI model. But this is kind of interesting, right? What you've added to it.
Yeah, so there's jokingly a number of people have added layers 8, 9, and 10 to the 7 OSI layers. And you'll notice that the 8 is financial and 9 is political. And there's a little circle that says you are here. And usually those define pretty much everything all the way down, because the financial may mean that you're not going to have as fat of a pipe, or you're going to have kind of older technology, or you're going to have older servers or bad placement for where your servers are going to be. And then the same thing with the political. I noticed when I was researching this, I went to Wikipedia to see if they had something similar to this. And actually, the next slide you have there, they actually added a 10th layer. This is stolen from Wikipedia. So they say government as well on top of that. So if, for instance, China is notorious for their great wall of great firewall that they have there. So that's going to be another impediment for streaming and such. And in there, so if you want, there's actually another sort of slide I have in there, which is kind of a generalized schematic of the internet and where things fail.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, that's perfect.
We'll talk about this.
When people usually think of the internet and they diagram it, they usually make that big cloud really at sort of the top there, and they just try to think of, you know, oh, everything's the man behind the curtain. We really don't need to worry about where our server. We need to figure out how our server is going to work, and somehow a client's going to connect, and there's this magic happens within the cloud. But if you actually sort of drill into it a little bit, you'll see that you're actually going through a number of different service providers, as well as what's called internet exchanges. And that's that little IX thing kind of in the lower right-hand kind of there.
Is that peering point? Is that what you call peering points?
That is. Normally there's a couple different ways that internet service providers peer with each other. And one is called transit, and that's they're expecting that their packets actually will transit through the company they may be buying bandwidth from and go all the way out to the rest of the internet. In many locations, and that costs money. And so many locations, companies, in fact, I've started one as well called San Francisco Metropolitan Internet Exchange, where we have about 6 or 7 of these peering fabrics scattered around San Francisco Bay Area. A company will throw a wire into literally a 10 gig or a 40 gig switch, and then anybody else who's on that switch, they can peer with. So you can have 10, 100, 1,000 people connected to this, and they can make some sort of policy or business agreement to exchange your traffic over this. So this means they don't have to go out and buy a jumper or have to backhaul it 12 miles away or 20 miles away or 100 miles away to get to where they want to go to. Very popular in data centers. So Equinix has these kind of things.
What you're describing sounds to me a bit like, not that they're rogue, but kind of like independent IX points, peering points, that avoid the whatever politics, costs, or whatever is at the normal peering points we think of, May East and May West and whatever else it may be.
Well, last they're no longer around so much. But the more well-known peering points are companies like Equinix, which has data centers in like Reston, Virginia, and Santa Clara, and things like that. And they'll have very, very large peering fabrics. There's another quite famous one in the San Francisco Bay Area called the Palo Alto Internet Exchange, which actually just got gobbled up by Equinix. Those are ones, and they charge usually quite a bit of money to connect to these things, and it's usually about $1 a megabit. It can be like about $1 a megabit per month to connect to this. So if you have a 10 gig port, it could, you know, you're paying like $10,000 a month for connecting to these things. In many cases in Europe, and I won't dwell on this too long, but I just want to mention that you said that there's kind of this rogue thing. But in many cases in Europe, there's a lot of nonprofit exchanges. So London Internet Exchange does this. There's AM6, which is in Amsterdam. There's DKIX, which is in Frankfurt. A lot of these are run as a not-for-profit. And the one that we have in San Francisco is actually a 501c6. It's not a C3 where it's like an educational thing. It's actually a C6. And you'll see companies like the NFL is a C6. It's a business. It's a nonprofit organization that's designed to support businesses. We run at an extremely low profit margin and try to encourage people to connect through these things. So it reduces the cost of connecting to the internet and providing services with the internet. But these places tend to cause problems occasionally. There was a famous sort of battle, if you probably remember this, about a year or so ago, where Comcast was blaming Netflix for dumping their traffic through an internet exchange, where in fact they should have been dumping it through a transit connection that they had arranged with them. And what that meant was that they overcommitted. So they were trying to dump, say, 40 gigs worth of traffic on a 10 gig port, and you have a lot of loss if you try to do that through an under-provisioned network switch.
Right.
So internet exchanges can have problems. Typically, you're running maybe 10 to 50% of your traffic through an internet exchange, and the rest of this is transit. But if your transit goes away, you may decide, an ISP may decide to move all of their traffic through the internet exchange and have an over, again, things won't work. It's trying to put, you know, 100 gallons through a straw.
Does this have to do, Tim, with the concept of saturation that we, back when Comcast and Netflix were having their tiff, and I'm a Comcast customer. Normally, I'm delighted, actually, with their service. But, of course, for me, for 2 or 3 months, Netflix didn't work very well. And I was just about to cancel Netflix, knowing that thinking that it wasn't really Netflix's fault. Maybe it was. I don't know. But I didn't. And then, you know, calmer heads finally prevailed. And, my Netflix works great now, better than ever.
Right. Well, actually, Netflix has a couple of other problems. And if you go back to that slide, I can talk to you about that as well.
Yeah, let's have a look at that.
So in the case of, I mentioned the typical congestion points, and I sort of point at them. So A would have been the internet exchange that I point at. B, the little arrow there, you could have, say, an under-provisioned a connection where Comcast may have a connection to, like, ISPD. And I'm not going to – I'm just saying Comcast in the general term. Say your cable provider may have a connection to an ISPD and they're trying to push too much traffic through their edge router. In the case of cable companies, they actually have an interesting thing. They're trying to use basically 50-year-old technology to provide internet service. So in that case, what they're doing is they're taking the cable system that they've been pushing television channels through, and usually unidirectionally because all they're doing is broadcast. And they converted these things so that they're bidirectional now. And what they've done is they've chopped out a couple of these channels to say, well, okay, we're not going to carry, you know, 12 or 24 megahertz worth of TV anymore. What we're going to do is we're going to dedicate that to data. And so that means that they may have 300 or 400 megabits worth of data that they can distribute through a neighborhood. And so what that means is a neighborhood who may also wants to watch Game of Thrones all at the same time because it just got released and they're going to binge watch the whole, you know, 6-part or 13-part series, right, means that it's the cable system that they have is going to be, again, saturated, and it's going to be quite lossy in that case. So it's not, you don't get a dedicated pipe when you hook, right, up your it's basically a shared media within the neighborhood. So that's a big congestion point that we have in trying to deliver films to providers who are typically connected to cable services. And we don't see this as much with telephone services like, you know, DSL and such, because it's not as much of a shared media. You have pretty much a dedicated pipe at that point.
And I always wonder if my neighborhood may be different or better engineered from Comcast. Every time I've ever done a speed test in the last 3 or 4 years anyway with Comcast, I always get more than I'm paying for, at least on any servers that are on Comcast or servers that I know are not very far away from a Comcast peering point. And I think I always hear that our own Joe Talbot, who works with me at Telos, for example, tells you that DSL has better jitter figures. It's better for VoIP than cable. I must just be lucky because my neighborhood, the cable service is just fantastic.
Right. And keep in mind, remember, Comcast went out and they bought up a bunch of tiny little providers, and they rolled this up into a gigantic acquisition play. And so they've been slowly trying to roll out and upgrade a lot of their facilities. And, it tried to move fiber closer to the neighborhood and set aside more channels. They actually have been upgrading a lot of the protocols. So for the protocol going over cable modems is called DOCSIS. Yeah. And you'll notice that, for instance, you can get cable modems that are DOCSIS 3 now. And so that means that they're actually a little bit more efficient along the lines of being able to push bits down a particular channel, but it also will tend to aggregate more channels so you can get more bandwidth through them. So not trying to slam Comcast too much. We're just kind of using them as a generic cable provider.
Yeah, yeah.
but they've had their difficulties, and it's been at various locations. So there's the neighborhood, which we just talked about. There was the little fight that we had between Netflix and Comcast, and actually Level 3 was a part of that as well. And then there's just network engineering in general. But the real problem that we typically have in trying to deliver audio is kind of the cruddy provisioning that usually users do for their home. Yeah. And the expectations that they have with Wi-Fi. So what will happen is they'll put their Wi-Fi next to their cable modem, which may be in their living room or something like that. But they may want to watch their film in the bedroom. And the bedroom may be two walls away. Or so that means that they're going to have really relatively low signal, or it may be in competition with their son who is, you know, playing World of Warcraft on the other line and trying to share that as well. So what this means is you don't have a consistent crappy sort of network condition. You have one that sort of varies up and down depending on who's using it and what they're trying to download at that moment and such. So this actually gets into what you talked about earlier, is how do you sort of adaptively manage a good viewing experience, knowing that you may have 1 megabit one moment and you may have 10 megabits the other moment, but you want to make that video or audio in some cases sound as good as possible.
Let me see if Tim, if I can say this a different way, because without adaptive streaming, the content provider, Fandor or Netflix or whoever it may be, the content or a radio station, my little state, WIQQ in Greenville, Mississippi,
right.
Without adaptive streaming, we as the content provider and doing the encoding, we've got to decide, okay, what's the worst case scenario that we want to serve? And that's the bit rate that we'll have to do. And what's the buffer size that we need to, you know, make sure that the player is doing. So we're going to provide a least common denominator experience for everybody.
Right.
Or we can do what some radio stations did for a while, and maybe a television did this for a while too, is you make the consumer choose, okay, click this bit rate or click this link for this bit rate or click this link for this bit rate. I mean, at our stations in American Samoa, we did that for a while. If you were on the island, you could hear our station at 96 kilobits MP3. If you were off the island, we only let you stream at like 48 kilobits HEAAC, just because of the cost of getting the streaming here and there and the reliability. So adaptive streaming lets us not have to program for the least common denominator connection.
Right. Exactly. And in this case, we're stressing the network a little bit more than just 48 kilobits or 96 kilobits or so.
Sure.
Our lowest bit rate is actually, and it's defined by Apple. Apple wants a bit rate that's 64 kilobits per second. And what it is audio only. So it's AAC with no video. And the idea behind that is that they want to make sure that there isn't a point where you're not hearing anything. So, you know, the video may freeze on the screen a little bit, but you're still hearing an audio track playback. Yeah. So that's the lowest we'll do. But the next one up that we do is 300 kilobits per second. So that means that we do about, I think it's 192K AAC audio. And so that means it's about 100K or so worth of video that's in that MP3 container that we have.
Is there any device upon which that looks good?
No,
okay.
it's meant. I mean, well, if you have something that has that doesn't have a lot of color graduation or has a lot of movement to it or anything else like that. So if it's a cartoon that has relatively static images and things like that, it'll look okay. But you know, you've seen this where the first time it'll show up, you'll see these big blotches of looking video, and then it sort of fills in. But again, we do this for those people who may be like on cell services or something like that, and who's trying to watch their video on, you know, something like this. And that you may be able to get away with something like that for a cell phone. But we have people actually wanting to sit down and watch this on a 52-inch screen, you know, a 1080 monitor. Eventually, we'll be doing 2K and 4K video as well. And so we go all the way up to about, I think it's about 10 megabits or so for our highest bit rates and such.
Oh, wow.
So eventually when we do 4K video, we're going to probably have to be pushing around 20 to 50 megabits or so.
Really?
To be able to do. Yeah.
That much, huh? Wow.
So,
Tim, we got to take a little pause here, take a breath.
Sure.
And think about, you know, the next couple things on your slides that you want to talk about. We've been talking about the issues or the congestion points, understanding that, and then understanding, well, you know, if we don't have an adaptive method of streaming it at a bit rate that's appropriate for the player's connection all the way through the internet to the provider, then we either have nothing, or we got to stream at a really low bit rate. And the idea here is to make it convenient and automatic that the consumer just hits play, whether this is audio or video, you know, and this has been going on in video for a while now. Now, adaptive rate streaming is becoming available to audio only broadcasters like radio stations, and the players are becoming built into operating systems. So that's what we're going to get to. And there you go. Tim Posar is our guest. He's the director of streaming technology for Fandor.com. And Tim has been in the radio business for quite a while, engineered at radio stations in California. And he knows a lot of the same people that that you and me know. Chris Tobin is with us here too. Chris, you're just soaking this all in, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for radio stations, I'm curious in the next portion of the show if Tim can talk about what's the most, economical way to get the best streaming audio you can for a radio station that wants their mobile audience to be in touch or stay in touch and keep the cost down for the radio station, or at least find a economical approach.
Funny you should ask. Our sponsor for this part of the show, I just got this box today. I was on my way to the Nashville, let me get this mic out of the way here. I was on my way to the Nashville SBE meeting where I gave a little talk about adaptive rate streaming. And as I'm leaving the house on my way over to the restaurant where the Nashville SBE chapter meets, here comes the UPS driver up the road. Now, the road I live on, there's only room for one car, and the UPS truck is about a car and a half. So anyway, I got out of the way, flagged down the UPS driver. He had a box for me. I knew he would. And this is what was in the box. This is our sponsor for this part of the show, Telos, our Zipstream division. And let's see, can I get that on the, there it is. It's way over here. There's the Zipstream logo. And this is the new, obviously it's hardware. We make this in software too. But this is the hardware box. This is the Zipstream R2. R meaning rack mount. And there we go. Thanks for cutting away from me. I don't know what's happened to my video. But this is the box. What this box does, this is your new transmitter for your cluster of radio stations. Because this will take 8 program inputs. 8. Up to 8. Now, you can buy this with just a couple of program inputs if you want. But and pay for more as you go. But you can have up to 8 program inputs, AES or Livewire, audio over IP, coming into this box. And from there, well, you can do all kinds of things. For each stream coming in, there's the back of it. And the AES inputs and outputs are that card over on the right. 8 stereo in, 8 stereo out, AES. And there's 2 network connections and, of course, all the usual other connections and dual power supplies. So you've got lots of reliability built in. So what this box does is it runs our Zipstream software that does audio processing, either Omnia 3 or optional Omnia 9 processing. And it does stream encoding. For each program coming in, you can encode in different ways if you want to. You want to make it, hey, for legacy, you want to encode an MP3 stream at, I don't know, 96 kilobits per second and send that off to your legacy Shoutcast server? No problem. Just do that. At the same time, take the same audio from the audio processor for that audio coming in and encode that in, say, AAC at a high bit rate for some other service you may be providing. Then if you want to encode at, let's say you want to do an adaptive bit rate stream, Apple HLS, for example, or Microsoft Smooth Streaming, for example, either way, you can encode at several different bit rates. At my station in Mississippi, I'm doing a test here. I'm encoding at 4 different bit rates in HEAAC, and that box I just showed you will absolutely do that. And make those files. It comes out with, you know, chunks, file chunks. And we'll put those either on a local server or it'll FTP them to another server and make those adaptive rate streams available to your audience. And we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. So that's what I'm so excited about this box. It's well built. It's amazing. It's heavy duty. It does make some noise, especially when you turn it on. Boy, those fans come on at full speed. They quiet down after a minute or two. And it is the way to go. It's your new transmitter for the internet, for your radio stations. And no more Mickey Mouse, no more free software, no more lame MP3 encoders and bad metadata. Oh, all the metadata is built in, too. Lots of filters for all your metadata activities are all built into that, so you can hook up your metadata aggregator programs or right from your automation systems right into there, too. Check it out. Thanks a lot, Telos and Zipstream, for sponsoring this portion of This Week in Radio Tech. All right. Glad to have them on. And you're watching episode 280 with Tim Pozar and Chris Tobin, along with me, Kirk Harnack. We're talking about adaptive rate streaming. So, Tim, we were just kind of getting through the congestion points, why we need adaptive rate streaming. Would you kind of give us now an intro into the notion of adaptive rate streaming? And how is it fundamentally different from the kind of serial sort of streaming that we've been used to, like Shoutcast or Icecast?
Right, the constant bit rate stuff that we've been doing. And actually, I run Icecast and Shoutcast servers for a lot of community radio stations and such, because it's a cheap technology. When you say lame MP3 encoders, it's actually an open software. It's not a degradation of a name of it, but that's actually a generic name for an MP3 encoder that was kind of an open source of the Fraunhofer encoder that's out there. The problem is, as you point out, and I know a number of companies that are trying to do streaming on the internet, and they're constantly running into the fact that they want a high quality stream out there, so they'll do something like 96 or 128, but they also want to be able to deliver this to, for instance, cars. So there, you know, I wrote a paper about 10 years ago for Motorola, where I called the cellular bands the new standard broadcast bands. And to that, what I did is looked at the cost of running a 5 kilowatt AM transmitter, say, someplace, knowing, you know, what the cost of the land is, the power, everything else, figuring the population of something like, you know, say the middle of the San Joaquin Valley or even San Francisco, what you could cover with that compared to the cost of putting a server in a data center and streaming out, particularly since the cost of bandwidth has been dropping. When I first started my ISP, we were paying $5,000 a month for a megabit worth of bandwidth. And at the data center, you can buy that for 50 cents a megabit at this point. So it's quite cost effective to put, and there really isn't any excuse to not put your station on the net so people could connect that way, because people are expecting that with applications like Tuned In and various other applications where they want to be able to listen to this and stream it through their Bluetooth to their car while they're driving down the road. So the cost has been dropping, but again, the roadblocks to be able to do that, particularly if you're trying to cover drive time in the car, is a little bit tougher. And so you have to start looking at things like adaptive bitrate, because driving down the road, you're also going to be competing against everybody else who's going to be using the cell service at that point. And then we, as a video provider, again, I outlined earlier what the congestion problems are here. So how adaptive works is typically a client will connect to the server. It will say, what streams do you have available that I can start using? This is all automagic. This is all done as part of the negotiation of the adaptive bitrate protocol. In the case of HLS, which is, again, Apple, as you said, Apple's protocol, which is actually pretty standard. You'll see it pretty much on every platform out there, like Roku and various other ones out there. They all use HLS. Okay. So it's pretty ubiquitous. And what will happen is it'll go out and get what's called a playlist manifest, and that will list all the bit rates. And in there, it will actually show you can grab this one, and it'll be 20 megabits, or this one will be 10 megabits, or whatever. And then the client will, through actually just an HTTP protocol, it keeps asking for chunks of a stream. It may start off at a low bit rate. So if you notice, you probably have had this experience where you connected to like Netflix, and at first everything looks really grainy. That's because they specifically are asking for the lowest bit rate. And what they're going to do is they're going to stair step up the bit rates until it figures out that, yep, this is the highest one I can do over this connection that I have with this customer.
I'm so glad you told me that. I thought it was my eyes. I'd start a cartoon for my son. It'd be all blurry. I'd rub my eyes for 5 seconds, and it's fine. That's not me. That's Netflix.
No, that's Netflix, and that's actually a sensible way of doing this, because See, if you went the opposite direction, in other words, you ask for the highest bit rate, you may be waiting until the cows come home for that to complete and for the connection to time out for it to start rolling down to lower bit rates and such. So this is a more conservative way of doing adaptive bitrate. They have conservative and liberal sort of strategies on doing adaptive bitrate. And so picking up the lowest bitrate, and this is what we do as well. We also do a couple other tricks with our adaptive bitrate. Normally what happens is our files are not live. So our files are static films. So we have, again, you know, we have about a half a dozen, actually we have about 12 or 15 different bit rates you can choose, or the client will choose from. And when it does do that, it says, okay, I want the lowest bit rate. it will get what's called a chunk list. And a chunk list is what's a listing of every single segment in a film. And in films, the way that we do our films, a segment or a chunk is every 10 seconds. In the case of video, you don't compress the same way you do with audio. In audio, you throw away what psychoacoustically you don't hear normally. And right. You probably had shows on that and talked about compression, how codecs work. In the case of video, what you do is you look at differences between the frames. So every, you have 24 frames per second or 30 frames per second. You'll typically have what's called a keyframe, and the keyframe will have the whole picture built into that frame. And then the next frame, which may be a B frame or a P frame or whatever, and that will be the delta. So in other words, what changed? In the case of, if you're looking at me right now, these posters behind me that you're seeing are not going to be part of those different frames because they're static. But my mouth moving will be part of those frames. And so you can get relatively high compression, and particularly if you start de-resing the sharpness of the film and such. So it will go out and get these chunk lists, which are every 10 seconds, which is how often we do these keyframes. So a keyframe will come by every 10 seconds, and then you'll have these delta frames in between that. So the client will try to go out and get the lowest bit rate. And then if it decides it needs to shift to a higher bit rate or a lower bit rate, it's going to do it on a keyframe boundary.
Okay, so the keyframe is the first information in each file chunk.
Exactly. Okay. If you change it between that, it won't know how to construct the frame or how
yeah.
To construct
for audio it. Only, it only has to be at the beginning of an MPEG audio frame. Not a video frame, but the framing that is done with bitrate reduced audio. So and those occur a lot more frequently than once every 10 seconds.
Right. Well, we try to do a lot of compression, and so if you do too many keyframes, it actually you won't be able to compress it down as much, obviously, because you don't have as many delta frames in there. And we also there's overhead on the client in trying to reconstruct these frames that are between the keyframes too. So there's a trade-off on compression as well as how much CPU power do you have on these little Roku boxes to be able to decode this compression. So we've spent quite a few years in finding that magic sauce that seems to work with most players.
Interesting. Wow. So we're learning about how this works with video but the same principles without the worry about the keyframes gets applied to audio. Now, I guess when audio goes with the video, it's just along for the ride and you're making your decisions based upon the keyframes, but the audio is there along for the ride with the same notion. But with audio-only HLS streaming, which heretofore broadcasters really haven't had available, and I'm not exactly sure why. I get, the bigger money was probably in the technology, the players, the encoders for video. But now it's making sense to do this for radio too, which is why iTunes Radio this is doing this. I believe BBC is doing this already. And hey, my little radio stations, I can bring up the file, the manifest file you talked about earlier. By the way, that manifest file, that's the one that has the .m3u8 extension, right?
That's correct.
Now, what does the extension mean? M3u8. That was weird the first time I saw that.
I don't remember exactly what that exactly means. You caught me on that one. There's a reason Google exists.
I'll look that up. But so when engineers, people who are watching and listening to the show, when you see that extension as part of this technology, that's the file that it's either one of two types of manifest files. What you want to do, what you end up doing, the player, you end up pointing your browser or your player to the URI of wherever that file is. Oh, my little son just stepped in here. Come here, Michael. Come here, buddy. It's a family show.
Great.
I'm sure there's something important he's got to tell Daddy here for a second. Yes, Michael? What is it?
Anyone guess what? Is it today? make it...
Your toy?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Right after the show, okay?
Okay.
Okay, all right. Love you, buddy.
What about now?
About right after the show, okay?
You got to work.
Give me half an hour and you can have it, okay? All right.
He's a cute kid.
Thanks. He takes after his mom. He gets a toy for being good for 3 days, and he had three stellar reports from school.
So, yeah. Excellent. Congratulations.
So, so now I can, just as an experiment, and this is kind of new to me, but I can point my Chrome browser on a Android phone to this manifest file sitting on a server in Greenville, Mississippi. It grabs that, it looks, which tells it the different bit rates that are available. I guess the player chooses one of them, and then it goes and gets that file that describes what file chunks are exist right now on that server, which they're ephemeral, by the way, unlike a movie where they stay there on the server, you know, until you go out of business. These are ephemeral. So we're only keeping three archive files for each bit rate. So each one's 5 seconds long. So we keep 15 seconds of audio at each bit rate on the server. And that second file, manifest file, also an M3U8, tells the player, go get this file now. And then it starts playing those sequentially.
Right. In the case, and when you're looking at video, you have the M3U8 file, which you just described. And what if the chunks themselves usually have a .ts, which is a... basically just a stream, it's a video stream, and that is chunks of what would be an MP4. An MP4, just keep that in mind, that's just a container that holds the H.264 video stream as well as an AAC or an MP3 video stream that you may have in the middle of that.
So to describe the hierarchy again, the TS file is what compared to the MP4 compared to the actual audio and video files?
Well, the TS file is just the 10-second chunks of the MP4 file. Okay. And so HLS doesn't have the concept, whereas actually there's a new protocol that's coming out, of being able to split out the video and the audio. So it just takes, in the case of a server that's doing HLS, they're going to do these 10-second chunks of the MP4. So you can really concatenate all these TS files together and create your MP4 again if you want.
Oh, sure. Okay.
There is a new standard that's coming out called MPEG-DASH.
Yes.
And that one will do things like give me a video bit rate at this rate and give me an audio bit rate at this rate, whereas you can't do that with HLS. It's basically whatever is bound into the MP4 container.
Interesting. Now, I in talking with our developers at Telos about our software that does smooth streaming or HLS, I noticed that, well, I told them, hey, when I play back our stream with, what's the name of the software? VLAN.
VLC?
VLC. When I play back the VLC, I was getting a little tiny gap every 5 seconds. And he said, yeah, not every player gets this yet. In our software, you can say, don't make them .aac files that actually contain the audio. Make them .ts files.
Right.
And so we just tell it to do that, and it does. And then VLC played it back perfectly because VLC understands transport stream .ts files. But then a new version of VLC, I think, either came out or is coming out that does understand the .aac files and butts them right up together without any gap.
Right. VLC is actually just an amazing Swiss Army knife that we use actually in-house for testing a lot of our streams and such. And it just works. trying to get clients. And we're on Roku. We're on, ported to Chromecast. We're on the web. Let's see, what other things? We're on iOS. So each one of those things, either you have to use the native HLS code. In the case of Apple, they actually have a pretty well-cooked implementation of HLS, and so we actually have pretty good luck with that. But the early days of Roku, like on the Roku One, we had a lot of problems with that, and that was partially because the client itself wasn't that well implemented. The other part was is that the Roku One was just underpowered. We could not deliver any bit rates above 1 megabit to a Roku One. And so That took us a long time to figure out why these Roku player customers were having so much problem with buffering. And until we said, okay, you have a Roku on it. Okay, we're only going to send you these bit rates.
Interesting. Okay, because I have hey, Chris, feel free to jump in any time here with your own experiences and questions. I have in my house, I've got three of the Roku 3 players. Love them. They're snappy. They play back right away. They're great. But I've got a couple of the old Roku ones, and one of them, believe it, is on. I've got a treadmill. I visit it every once in a while, and the treadmill's got a TV screen built into it, and so I have to use the composite output from the old Roku one into the composite TV screen. Anyway, so while I'm jogging on this treadmill, I want to watch stuff, and oh my God, is it slow! It's right. Just painful. 2 minutes to buffer some ordinary video.
Yeah, they just kind of underpowered the processor on that, and particularly now you're working with again companies like ours and such who want to be able to push out HD content and such, and these little guys just can't keep up with it. So take your Roku One, put it someplace else, go out and get a Roku 2 or Roku 3, or go to an Apple TV or something else like that.
Yeah, yeah, okay, cool. Where were we going with this? So where do you think, the world of video is so standardized now with adaptive rate streaming. Just as you said, you buy a Roku, you've got it built in. Safari browser has this built in.
Right.
The Chrome browser, at least on this Android, doesn't have it. The player's built in, but when I brought up for the first time that manifest file from my own test setup, it asked me, "What do you want to use to play this back?" And it gave me VLC. And I thought, right. Try this—the dumbest player that this thing comes with. And I tried that, and it works perfectly.
Right. Ever since I think it was Android 4.2. They started putting in HLS support. So actually, at this point in time, pretty much any newer phone, of course, anything from Apple is going to have it because they developed it. But if you have an older, if you have like a sort of like a 4.0 or Android or older, you're going to have a hard time with trying to play back anything with HLS.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, so how do you think? I mean, if I'm a broadcaster, I'm thinking, okay, maybe I should at least start experimenting with an HLS stream. Am I going to be
are you going to be able to deliver to all the clients out there?
Am I going to be able to deliver, or do I need to wait a lot around for MPEG Dash to get more popular, or is HLS really, should I just jump in with that?
Well, MPEG Dash actually, I'd wait a little bit for that too, because they're actually trying to use a new video codec called H.265.
Yeah.
Which has about twice as a good compression on that. And so those codecs are not well distributed at this point, too. So I'd stick with HLS using H.264. AAC seems to be pretty ubiquitous as well. And it actually sounds pretty good. So if you want to do the lowest common denominator, I would do that for right now. And then, of course, there's a lot of people that still support, in the case of audio, MP3. And so you can always fall back to that.
Let's talk for a second about the server technology involved. One of the things, our guest next week is a friend of the show, Greg Oganowski.
I know Greg.
With Orbin, and he's his company now. He does this Streams software that is very nice for iOS devices for listening to good quality HEAC streams on the internet. Anyway, so Greg was explaining to me a few weeks ago, and I found it to be absolutely true, that one of the neat things about HLS or adaptive streaming is it doesn't require a server that's designed with server-side streaming software on it. So it doesn't necessarily have all these kind of constant connections to all of its clients going on. It's a file server. You're serving files.
Right.
And so if you want to roll your own, I mean, an Apache web server will do it.
Trivial. It's trivial. Yeah. The original video streaming, you probably remember Real Audio and such, and they were doing video streaming. But what caught on after that was Adobe Flash, and they used a thing called RTMP. And so the decisions about adaptive bitrate were on the server side. It wasn't on the client side. And it was a constantly open connection. So you had to buy their product to be able to use RTMP. And, of course, Flash was not cheap as well, their service and such. The interesting thing about RTMP also is the fact that it used a non-standard port. Every time I went to like a hotel, I would run up against a firewall that would only allow me to connect to port 80 or port 443, in other words, the HTTP or web ports. And if I tried to do something like, 1935, which is what RTMP uses, I'm blocked. Apple and everybody else is trying to do something a little bit more sane and use HTTP ports. So what happens is, in HTTP is a stateless connection. So what it means is that it will go out, and that's why I have to do these chunks. It'll say, get me the next chunk, and then it closes the connection. And then it says, give me the next chunk, and closes the connection and such. So you can automatically, you could take a video file, chop it up into these segments. And so each TS segment would be an individual file, and you put a manifest on an Apache server, an Nginx server, or whatever else you want to do. And you all of a sudden have an HLS video stream or audio streaming server.
And it's fair to reiterate that the smarts, once you've got these files on a server, static in the form of a movie or ephemeral in the form of a streaming audio, is it fair to say that the smarts really exist in the player, in the client?
It does, yeah. And again, conversely with RTMP, the smarts were in the decision-making with the adaptive bitrate was on the server side. In the case of HLS or HDS or MPEG-DASH, the smarts, as you call it, are in the client side. So this is why we actually have to be very careful when we do, when we construct our clients for our various platforms, is we want to make sure that the adaptive bitrate technology and their strategy and things like that will work for rather congested networks or really adverse networks. Like, we even have people, trying to stream through their satellite connection, their direct PC connection and such. So we really try to serve and try to develop our adaptive bitrate clients so that they can even survive that kind of transport.
You know, that brings up a good question. I believe that, in fact, I was just getting ready to look at the container file here. I've got it in a keynote presentation that I gave. So one of the parameters in the M3U8 file for each bitrate is pound x-x target duration colon. Target duration.
Right.
Now, can you tell me what target duration? In our case, it's set to 4. Is that 4 seconds?
I assume that's probably a 4-second window, yeah. And so, okay. Particularly for live streams, you're not getting the whole chunk list. So in a movie, as I said, say for instance you have 4 bit rates or something like that, it's going to in many players, what they'll do is they'll try to download the chunk list, in other words a listing of all the TS segments for every single bit rate. In the case of live, you can't do that because you haven't pre-indexed the audio. It has to be able to sort of, and particularly with audio as well, there's no necessarily keyframes associated with it. It's going to have to figure out when it can switch or how much it needs to grab for.
Well, part of the way this works is, and I tell me if I'm explaining this right, because this is what I'm saying in my seminar, is that, okay, so you've got a file chunk that is 5 seconds worth of audio. You've got this at several bit rates, but you got 5 seconds worth of audio. And the player knows this. The player is told by the manifest file that this is a 5-second long file, or maybe 5,000 milliseconds. And then the player has to see, well, how long is it taking me to download a 5-second file? Is it taking me 0.3 seconds or 1.9 seconds or, well, heaven forbid, 4.8 seconds?
And that's exactly how it determines what the bandwidth is. I'm glad you brought that up. And what we do is we monitor that. We actually look every, I think it's every 5 seconds or every 10 seconds or so, we get what's called a heartbeat back to our servers and such to know how fast they were able to get like a 1 megabyte file. So that 5 seconds you have at 96K or 128K or something like that is going to be a predefined file size, particularly if you have a constant bitrate file. or stream, and then downloading it, you can measure how many bytes you got. You can measure how long it took, and that's an easy calculation of what your bandwidth is. And from that, it could say, oh, you know, I got that, and that was about 10 megabits or so. I'm going to ask for a 5 megabit stream next time.
Ah, good. That's how I thought it worked. So in the case, you're talking video speeds there. In audio speeds, yeah. I don't know that the players start out with the lowest bit rate. I hope they do. I'd like to maybe use some Wireshark or maybe VLC to help me see that bit rate that it does. But let's say I got 4 bit rates available from 16 kilobits up to 128 kilobits. I'm hoping that the player grabs the file for the lowest bit rate first, because that's a tiny file. It's like 12K. And yeah. Bam, gets that one down. And then that can't be 12K. That wouldn't be right. But anyway, it grabs these files and it says, hey, I downloaded that so fast, I'm going to go for the next bit rate or even a much higher bit rate. And I hope that's the way it works. We talked about, you know, not only for bandwidth sake, so that you're not watching, you know, no video or hearing no audio for a while more of it buffers in. We're eliminating that problem. But also, if you grab the lowest bit rate file and bring that in first, your video or your audio starts quicker. So the consumer gets a better, they hit play and bam, it starts quicker than if it had to download a great big file.
We also do a couple other tricks. Remember how I said we have about 12 or so different transcodes that we, or bit rates that we use. And in many times what happens is we don't pre-segment our files. So on the file server that we have, it's just one gigantic MP4. And so what happens is when a customer connects, we use Akamai and we use a couple other things like Wowza for our streaming. It literally has to go through and index that file. And if, say, for instance, we have a two-hour movie or so, that means it has to index all 12 of those transcodes. And that could take quite a bit of time. And also, it can take quite a bit of time to transfer those chunk lists back down to the client. So one of the tricks that we do at the trade, and I'm not giving away too much because everybody probably does this as well, is we use clients that will ask for the lowest bit rate and only ask for that chunk list. And then if it makes a decision, okay, you know what, I want to go to a higher bit rate or so, then it'll ask for that chunk list. So in that case, we're not trying to index all 12 transcodes at the same time for a two-hour film. We're only indexing one transcode. And then if it decides to make a shift, it'll only index another transcode. So the idea is that we really want this thing to start up within 2 or 3 seconds. Most people are pretty tolerant of a movie taking a second or two to start up. But yeah, if they're talking, you know, 10, 15, 20 seconds or something like that, they're going to start getting a little annoyed.
I hear you. Yeah. I'm annoyed. We're out of time. we're gonna hear from our last sponsor, and then we're gonna try to wrap the show up with either a tip or a little story or something that would be a good kicker to leave our audience with. Chris, you too, and Tim,
yep.
Hopefully you'll have a little something for us. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, episode 280, with Chris Tobin here, and also Tim Pozars, our guest, talking about multi-rate adaptive streaming for both video and audio, kind of why it's necessary and kind of how that's implemented. I'm excited to be talking about this to different groups. In fact, I'm going to be at the Baltimore, Maryland SBE chapter on the 18th of November to talk to them about this, and also the New York City SBE chapter on the 19th of November. So, Chris, I hope to see you there on the 19th if you can make it. Our show brought
Absolutely.
To you in part. Yeah, good. And maybe we can go out and have a beverage or two, you know, maybe before. We should do it before. Our show is brought to you by the folks at Lavo, L-A-W-O, console company, pronounced Lavo, but spelled L-A-W-O. They make, you know, those big, honking, incredibly complicated consoles for multi-track mixing and surround sound, TV trucks, big venues. That's what Lavo does. Well, and they also are a proponent of audio over IP in Europe with the Ravenna standard. They're also behind the AES-67 audio over IP standard. Well, Lavo also has a line of consoles that are meant for, let's say, smaller applications for, you know, us guys in radio. They make a console called the Crystal Clear console. And this console is just, it's so cool. You know, 20 years ago, I was dreaming of a touchscreen controlled audio console. I thought this would be really cool. And, you know, the tech just wasn't there yet. We certainly didn't have multi-touch 20 years ago, or at least, you know, civilians didn't. Maybe the military did, but, you know, we didn't have any access to that. But I thought, wouldn't it be great if you could have an audio console that was on a touchscreen. And that means you could modify the way it looked for your particular needs at that time. If you needed, what kind of functions do you need? Hey, is the traffic report ready? You could have a helicopter fly in on the screen and, you know, sit over a fader like, I'm here, I'm right here, push this up, and you know, helicopter reports are ready. That kind of thing. Well, you know, the Lavo console doesn't have a helicopter flying around, but it does have on-screen multi-touch faders. You can run several faders up and down at the same time. You can, you know, hit buttons on and off at the same time. The whole layout is designed for your fingers to touch and to do so accurately and easily with this multi-touch touchscreen monitor. Now, the heart of the console, of course, isn't the touchscreen. That's just the control surface. The heart of the console is a well-proven design that they've used for some years now on their Crystal consoles. It's a one-rack unit box, custom-designed with mic inputs, high-quality preamps there, mic inputs, line-level analog inputs and outputs, some AES digital inputs and outputs, and also now it's got Ravenna and AES-67 audio over IP, right through the networking jack, right on the back. Plus, because it needs to be reliable, it comes with dual power supplies. You can order it that way with dual power supplies, and that makes it a really solid platform for audio audio inputs and outputs, and for all the mixing, and even a certain amount of microphone processing, for example. Parametric EQ is built in. You can have that available on your inputs. Now, you have that device goes in a rack. Now, it's pretty silent, not much noise there. It can go in your rack in your studio, or it can go in a back in a rack room or something. But then in your studio or wherever you want to put it, maybe you want to do your show from your desk, your office, you put the Crystal part of the Crystal, the clear part of the Crystal Clear, and that's the touch control surface. If you go to the website, you want to see how this thing works. Mike Dosh does a really good demo of this. The website, lavo.com, and look for radio products and look for the Crystal Clear console. In the upper right-hand corner, you can click on that icon there, thumbnail, I should say, of the video where Mike Dosh explains and walks you through how this console works. Of course, it networks with other consoles that are on the same Ravenna or AES network, and it's just amazing. Check it out if you would. I think this is a great idea, and you might like it too. Lavo.com, L-A-W-O, and the Crystal Clear console. Thanks, Lavo, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, we're talking to Tim Pozar about multi-rate streaming. He explained some of the inflection points, the congestion points, I should say, on the internet, and how multi-rate streaming can reduce the problems that your end listeners and viewers have with that. So, Chris Tobin, let's jump on you for a second here. Do you
sure.
You haven't gotten a word in edgewise here on the show. Sorry.
That's okay. That's the way it goes.
Yeah. So what tip might you have for us besides don't fall backwards into the rack of the wall of punch blocks?
Yes, you don't want to do that. Well, that's not a good thing. One of the things to consider, I just recently this week worked on a project in a performance studio, and we were doing recordings using Neumann microphones, condenser mics. And interesting thing, we picked up a local radio station on the mic cables, and it wasn't a good thing. And we discovered that the panels on the wall, the snake panels, interestingly enough, we always forget these things. You know, ground loops happen between two devices that have the ability to create a return path. Well, a microphone technically doesn't have a return path. It's a single-ended device. However, the microphone cable ground is still used through the chassis connection. So I'm going to show you here a standard XLR, right? You're familiar with that, the right-angle XLR there. And we'll look at the back of a connector. You'll see right there above the three pins is a little tab.
Right, the tab.
That little tab is to the chassis, okay? Right. So you take pin one ground, tie it to the chassis as well as to the shield. So that's what it would look like typically, red, black, and shield. And at the very top, there is that little chassis pin again. That creates the complete ground all the way through, and it also creates a ground plane so the RF can be dissipated off. Believe it or not, I did 24 of these on a panel, grounded the pin one to the shield of the chassis, and the radio station we were hearing at the very, very low high gain levels of the preamp went away. Only to come back on a certain cable. It turns out the mic cable didn't have double shielding, therefore the shields didn't properly work. So that's the tip. definitely use the pin one to shield the chassis. It definitely makes a difference.
And
you may not notice unless you're using microphones.
Is that your
default? You do this on one end, right?
Two people talking once.
No, I'm sorry. So you do this on one end of the cable as opposed to both ends of the cables, right?
Well, the other end was a preamp. So the other, the other end was a cable. It was an XLR by itself. But yeah, you did it at the panel where the microphone met it, so that if there was any stray RF riding along the cable, it would stop it at the panel. It worked really well, actually. So I was able to go deep down into the noise floor of the preamp and make for nice recordings and not listen to the local, at the time I think it was Rush Limbaugh programming. So made for some fun. And the other tip is, at AES we talked about this. And Kirk, you remember on the panel we talked about the new way of creating content. So I was talking to a few folks that called me recently, last day or two, about this little device from Digigram called a Q-Mic. It allows you to properly interface, in this case, to an iPhone. And it's the four rings for a standard iPhone interface. Keeps proper impedance and switching. And the nice thing is, look at the time, it's 8:16. It's nicely designed because it has a right angle. Oh, let's see if I get this real close. This is important. Talking to one of the news folks that came up to me at AES. Oops, they didn't want to do that. The right angle actually saves it from getting broken off, believe it or not. So those are the two tips. Proper ground on your XLRs.
That pigtail there is from Digigram?
Yeah, it's a Digigram device. And oddly enough, let me see if I can throw this for those who will watch the video. You'll see this.
It's a line level input as well as the mic XLR.
Yeah, line and mic. And it's designed to get tossed around. I actually was told this is a ruggedized, I guess, what they call it, ABS plastic. Okay. So I got to make sure I got that right. Yeah. Oops. Go this way.
Chris, you and I have also discussed the similar adapter from Mickey, from our friends over at Tecnica Del Arte. Yeah, the guys who make the Lucy software. And
yeah, I have one of those too.
But I'm glad you pointed that one out from Digigram. They make good stuff.
Well, I have both, and I've used both in different applications. And it turns out that the Digigram one had a line input, so it made it really convenient. And also, it was just the way it was designed. It was, you could bounce it around. And the Lucy one, I believe you can bounce around pretty much as well. Just slightly different design. But they both work really good.
Cool. Thank you for those. Very
cool. Hey, you're welcome.
I did have a follow-up question, Chris, on the pin one to the tab. I like to go by rules of thumb, with exceptions if I have to. And Tim brought up do you ground that only at one end, like we were oftentimes used to with shielding? Or is it your default to hook that up every place there's an XLR and then maybe snip it if you have to? What rule of thumb might you have for that?
Well, no, this was used for microphones. So since microphones were a single-ended device, you can get away with it on both ends. The other end of this was a snake XLRs, free-hanging XLRs, which didn't have it on the tab. It was just on the one side. So it's it was sort of creating a ground plane. There was a name for it. I looked it up, but it was interesting how as soon as I alligator clip from pin one to the tab, and the RFI interference dropped by 50%, and then I just did a little short solder, copper wire, like eighth of an inch, and boom, gone completely. And we were down like minus 100 dB on the preamp, and it was nice and clean.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, we heard more of the preamp noise inside the microphone element than we did on the cable.
Less Rush Limbaugh and more preamp noise.
Yes.
Okay.
Better white noise.
Not that you increased the preamp noise, but now that's what you heard.
Yes.
Yeah. Less Rush, more pre. Okay. Good deal. Tim, you so kindly agreed to give us a tip or a story or something. Have at it.
Oh, well, actually, I was trying to think of what one. You were talking about that. The last console, and I constantly see, they say, well, they have two power supplies on it, and for redundancy, and I constantly see people who take servers like the one that you have there from Telos have two power supplies, and they'll plug it into the same circuit, and that's not what you're supposed to be doing with two power supplies, and it's most of the time it's the power supplies that don't fail. It's the circuit breaker that fails.
Right.
So the idea behind having two power supplies is being able to move the equipment back and forth without having to take down the box because you have to take down a circuit and such. So anyway, Keep it on two different circuits, guys.
That's a great point. And sure, having two power supplies is a certain level of redundancy. But if you really want to take advantage of that, which you should, you need to have your racks wired with two different circuits, preferably one of them on, you know, the infrastructure UPS, and the other one, you know, maybe on just some totally separate circuit, a different UPS that feeds.
It could even be on shore power. You know, you could have one, you know, if your UPS can fail too.
Yeah. Hey, guys, we do have to go. I appreciate Suncast for staying a little bit late and helping our show go long and producing it for us. Thanks very much. Coming up next week, Greg Oganowski is our guest. November the 19th, we're going to have for you the story behind the FM Master Antenna 50th Anniversary Celebration. Tom Silliman spoke at that. Also, Bob Tarsio, Frank Foti, and other guests as well talked about that in the Empire State Building. It's what happened last week, but it's the stuff afterwards. It was the seminar that went on. We're going to have that for you in 2 weeks, so stick around for that. Tim, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. Sure love to have you
My
back.
My pleasure. Sometime.
All right.
Thank you very much. We'll do.
Chris Tobin slaving away in the punch rack room there. Chris, thanks for taking the time to join us. By the way, Chris, your camera looks fantastic.
It's the same camera I've been using for 5 years now.
great lighting. I don't know. It just looks great.
It's a small little spot that I travel with, and it's the usual setup.
Well, good deal. Must have good internet there, too. Thanks to Suncast, and thanks to Andrew Zarian for providing us the bandwidth and the distribution on the GFQ network. Check out the other shows on GFQ. We got to go. We'll see you next week. This Week in Radio Tech.